You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 282 by Rudolf Steiner, a cycle of lectures entitled Speech and Drama, translated by Mary Adams. This is Lecture 13, and I again provide this forewarning. It is a lot of quotations that I won't be reading, and afterwards Steiner making comments on them. So there is some useful discussion, of course, in the lecture here itself, but by and large it might be irritating not to have that text in front of you as you read his responses. Again, Lecture 13, entitled The Study of the Text from Two Aspects, Delineation of Character and the Form of the Play, given on the 17th of September 1924. My dear friends, for the dramatist, the play is finished when he has composed it, when he has put it into words. If he intends it for the stage, then while composing it, he must all the time hear and see it taking place. A play that may truthfully be called a work of art has been seen by the author. He has had it before his mind's eye, just as it should unfold when performed on the stage. If this is not so, if the dramatist has not the power continually to, in quotes, behold the stage, to feel beating within him as he writes the lifeblood of the stage, then the actor can do very little with that play. And now, when the dramatist has finished his work, the written play is for the actor what the score is for the musician. The poem, the work of art, has in a sense disappeared. The written text is like a musical score. From the text, the actor has to recreate the poem in his performance on the stage, even as the musician recreates the music from the score. For the score is a kind of zero point between composer and performer. There they meet. It should be the same with the text of the drama. But in order to attain his goal, the actor will have to prepare himself in two directions. The first thing needed is that the characters in the play are thoroughly understood, that the individual actor must have a thorough grasp of his own part goes without saying, but no part can be rehearsed except in conjunction with the other parts. And the producer has to see that all the parts play into one another in the right way. Thus, besides being studied individually, the characters will have to be brought into right relation with one another, so that the play, as it takes its course on the stage, shall in this respect present a rightly colored, a well-integrated whole. And this it will do if we have, first of all, practiced the art of delineation of character. It is an art that can be studied from what we have already seen to be the essential elements of drama. Let me show you how this can be done. Again, I will proceed by taking an example. In an earlier lecture, we had a play under consideration that can once more be helpful to us here, for it is excellent material for the study of delineation of character, and also for the other necessary study, which I will explain later. Particularly striking, however, is the skill in the delineation of character that is evinced in this play. I refer to Hämmerling's title Danton und Robespierre. If it is our aim to achieve a complete and true delineation of character, in other words, so to place each separate character on the stage that in the working out of their mutual relationships a whole is attained, an inwardly integrated whole, then we must, before all else, set out to study the play just from this point of view. In the play we are considering, we shall find four characters whom we can well single out for particular study. There are, of course, many others we could choose, but for our present purpose we cannot do better than concentrate on these four: Robespierre, Hébert, Chaumette, and Danton. A full study of the drama as a whole, a full study of the drama as a whole would naturally have to include also the rest of the cast. As far as our immediate study is concerned, we shall require to come to the point where we can take a survey of the complete drama with its various characters. And then, having done this, we shall be in a position to give to some particular character its right performance, allowing it to be neither isolated from the others nor eclipsed by them. Assuming, therefore, that you have worked through Hammerlings, Danton, und Robespierre in this way, and have also made yourselves thoroughly familiar with all that we have been considering in these last days, you will be able to go forward with clarity and confidence, and place these four characters on the stage, showing up the varying shades of their several qualities and dispositions in their relation to one another. Take first Danton. We shall find, if we have understood the play aright, that Danton will express his own inner soul best if we connect him with the sound feelings A, E. A, E. Danton. A, E. To act the part with this sound feeling will bring the jovial side of his nature to expression. There will then be something large and generous about his manner as he comes onto the stage. And when Danton has to move about on the stage, then, if you have come to a really deep understanding of him, you will instinctively be tempted to let him walk like this, knees held rather stiff and feet firmly planted on the ground. You will even feel that his arms, too, should be a little stiff at the elbow. He will move them as though he could not bend them right up, but only at a rather obtuse angle. Yes, you could very well have the impression that Danton is a man who would never be able to sing either a major or a minor third. If this is the feeling you have about his character, then you may be sure the true Danton will be there on the stage, taking his right place among the other characters. And you will be impelled to let him be constantly making gestures with the mouth that help to produce the right tone of voice, pressing the lips forcefully into the corners of the mouth. Danton should in fact be spoken with lips nearly closed and stretched to their utmost, but as if there at the corners of the mouth they met with some powerful resistance. All this is a direct and perfectly natural outcome of a serious study of the part, and that is how it should be. Then, when Danton has to speak, we shall have a Danton there ready. I will now illustrate this for you, taking for the purpose the second scene of the play, where he steps out in front of the people and speaks to them in true Danton manner. There's a quote, end of quote, Steiner again. Do you see? There you have Danton's large and yet at the same time revolutionary manner. I want you to understand that I am accentuating what is characteristic of Danton, and that this accentuation has its particular value. I do it on purpose, to show you how you can find your own way to a true delineation of character. And you will furthermore discover, if you are prepared to carry your expression of the character so far, that Danton will have to speak every y and every l and whatever sounds resemble them in a manner that is all his own. So we have for Danton a, e, y, l. And now let us look at Hébert. When the character of Hébert begins to come alive for us, we shall find he is not a man of action like Danton, nor has Hébert been endowed with Danton's jovial disposition. Danton, with his big, broad mouth, gives us the impression that he will be large and liberal in his actions, too. We shall even feel inclined to choose a broad-shouldered person to play him, should it happen that one is available. We could, of course, also adapt the clothes to give more breadth. Danton's outward appearance would then be in accord with his speaking. Hébert, on the other hand, will have to be of medium size. He must not look big and stout. With Hébert we get the impression that he is continually on the point of stepping forward, but suddenly hangs back and goes no farther. Whenever he has to move on the stage, the actor will have to show his hesitation. He will begin to step out, but then always stand still again. For Hébert is a man who only denounces and scolds. He is not a man to get things done. And this trait the actor will have to reveal by continually starting to walk and then stopping short. You will find that Hébert is particularly at home in G and K. The utterance of these sounds gives him a feeling of satisfaction. The actor will take care to note that these sounds occur and will attune his whole speaking accordingly. He will see that Hébert grüllt und jüllt, bawls and howls when he is cross, ö and ü, and that with g and k he is as pleased and happy as Danton is with y and ö, l. Hébert, ö, ü, g, k. As the audience leaves the theater, you have to catch them saying to one another, "By Jove, how that fellow who plays Danton says ya. No one else in the world could say ya as he does. And did you hear the way Hébert hacks at the words with his k and g? It's simply marvelous." Hämmerling prepares us well beforehand for the situation in the scene. A citizen steps forward to announce the approach of the goddess of reason, whose festival is now about to be celebrated. Quote, a long quote there, close quote, Steiner again. That then is Hébert. Let us now turn to Chaumette. If we study the part carefully, we shall feel we can detect in Chaumette a sort of sowing or sighing in U, indicating a timidity which he conceals under a show of bravado. He tries all the time to stand up to his feeling of fear with ö, and so we have the mood ü, ö. Chaumette's will not be a speaking that goes to extremes in any direction. There will be in it a savor of supplication, but of a rather poor and mean kind. The sounds ha and sh will frequently occur, and all the time there will be a sort of insincere heaving and sighing. Chaumette, ü, ö, ha, sh. If we can speak the part with this feeling, then it will be Chaumette. And there's a quote, close quote, Steiner again. Chaumette, you see, makes it plain that he wants not only to haul the tyrants down from their thrones, but to push them out of their pulpits. This is the character Hämmerling gives him. And if you study the part, letting yourself hear Chaumette speak with the voice of a priest, who has grown rather insincere, then you will have hit upon the tone that should be maintained for Chaumette throughout. Robespierre may be said to be the character that interests Hämmerling most of all. He should appear rather tall on the stage. Whatever he may have been in real life here in Hämmerling's play, Robespierre is a tall man, rather thin and worn, and all the sounds that he utters tend somewhat in the direction of E. There is always a decided contraction at the middle of his palate. He is, moreover, always ready to talk of great matters, to, quote, embrace the world, close quote, in rather grandiloquent phrases. E-O, E-O. These are the sounds you hear in Robespierre. Then Robespierre is also very much the schoolmaster, whose speaking abounds in D and T. He has a distinct liking for D and T. The pointing sounds. Robespierre, E, O, D, T. And now there is a passage in the play that can be particularly helpful to us if we want to have a complete picture of the character of Robespierre. Look up the scene that takes place in the house of the carpenter Duplay, where Robespierre has his lodging. The scene is laid in a kind of anteroom, which divides Robespierre's apartments from the rooms and workshop of his landlord. Here, then, we have Robespierre at home. Hermeling begins the scene by letting Robespierre indulge in a little self-admiration, in the true E.O. mood. We need to take note of this trait in Robespierre if we are going to present him on the stage, for it provides us with a key to his character. Robespierre sets great value on what others think about him, but he would not like to admit it, either to himself or to them. And he undoubtedly has at the same time a good deal, as we said, of the schoolmaster in him, and even gives the whole revolution something of that tone. I am not, of course, speaking of the Robespierre of history. All that, I am saying, refers to the Robespierre of Hammerling's play. Danton, Billaud Varin, and the rest are ready to hang people who say anything in favor of the old aristocracy or royalty, or who even dream about them. But Robespierre, he would like to hang persons who are guilty, for example, of writing an R in the wrong place. He detects in a spelling mistake like this an unforgivable conservatism, which hinders the guilty person from taking his place in the new order of things. Schoolmasters, accordingly, whose pupils do not spell correctly, these in particular he is ready to hang. The two traits are remarkably well brought out by Hemmerling, and we shall find we can understand the character of Robespierre if we study the part with these traits in mind, and with the sound feelings that belong to them. There's again a quote, and then close quote, and Steiner again. There you have the tones of mood and the voice that need to be carefully studied. As I said just now, I am accentuating the special features of the characters. Here I have purposely exaggerated a little in order to help you to come to a deep and thorough understanding of the whole figure of Robespierre as portrayed by Hammerling. For nothing less will suffice if you want to act the part. You will need to find your way right into the very heart and being of the character. And now, when you have learned to understand Robespierre in these two aspects of his character, you will continue your study of the part further. I would like you to take what I am saying here rather as giving a description of how these matters can be gradually brought before students in a school of dramatic art. Having, then, brought your students so far, you may take with them that moment in the play when Robespierre is called upon to account for the fact that he is not willing to be made dictator, when all the time he definitely wants to be it. His friend Saint-Just asks him why it is he spurns the title. And now Robespierre is compelled to divulge something of his true character. Yes, it comes out. And at the same time a third trait of his makes its appearance. We are shown Robespierre the dogmatist, the rationalist, perpetually wanting to pose as schoolmaster for the whole world, ready also to be an opportunist for that end, promulgating a theory of which we are to be repeatedly reminded as the play proceeds. For from now on, Robespierre makes every endeavor to justify himself by it with subtlety and precision at the bar of reason. Saint-Just says to him, and there's a quote and then close quote, Steiner again, Robespierre is naturally deeply annoyed at such a question. It probes his weaknesses to the quick, those weaknesses of his that are at the same time the things that make him great. He grows restless, walks up and down. Saint-Just remains standing still. Robespierre does not answer at once. He has, you see, to find a way to justify himself before the tribunal of reason. He walks to and fro to gain time. Then he claps Saint-Just on the shoulder, quote, there's a long quote here, end of quote. There you have Robespierre. That is, then, the first way in which we should learn to study our text, namely from the aspect of delineation of character. When we have made progress in this, we can pass on to the second, which consists in learning to give the relevant coloring to the play in all its scenes from beginning to end, but always so that the fundamental tone of the play as a whole is maintained throughout. Today we will begin to consider certain things we shall need to understand for this. Then tomorrow we shall be in a position to carry the study further. You will remember, my dear friends, that I showed you how the vowels can be thought of as forming in their sequence a kind of scale. I want now to write them in a circle, making 7 halts or stopping places in the circle, where I will write in the vowels in order, so that the last comes round again to the first. Thus, this time they will not be side by side in a line, but inscribed on a circle, so that the series returns upon itself. Ah, A, E, O, A, U, E, U. I read that again. Ah, A, E, O, A, E, U. Make 7, and U is the 8th. When now we study plays in connection with this circle of vowels, we discover something of extraordinary interest. Imagine we are studying a play and find we want to arrange for the play as a whole to have a mood that arises out of the feeling of ooh. We want to let the audience feel from the beginning that up there on the stage, the prevailing general tone corresponds to the feeling one has with ooh. We shall then get each actor to speak his part in such a way that something of the ooh mood is present. This may be done by accentuation here and there, or again by the coloring the actor gives to his voice. Then as the play goes on, we find we have to pass on from ooh to ah to a, and now to e. See the arrow in the drawing. The play has thus moved on in respect of mood as far as E. We feel, however, that we cannot now go on from E to O. We have instead to come back. We have to let the mood come back again to A, with a slight tendency of warding something off, and yet, after all, we allow it to come near us again. We return to A. But before U, we call a halt, at most letting ooh only begin to sound. When we go through the play in this manner, giving it throughout the right coloring in accordance with the feelings that belong to the several vowels, what have we? We set out from ooh, that is to say fear. We go on farther and come to e. With e is associated the experience of compassion. We have now reached the middle of the play. In the remaining acts, we are obliged to retrace our steps. We have to come again, even if warding it off a little, for we must not lose hold of what is happening. We have to come back to ah, and that is the mood in which the play ends. We have thus found in the play this sequence: fear, compassion, wonder. But these are the very moods of soul of which Aristotle speaks, although, of course, he does not connect them with sounds, as we have done. Fear, as we set out in ooh, and returning at last to wonder in ah, and in ah, coming to a standstill before reaching ooh. For of fear only a faint murmur still lingers on at the end of the play. And now, suppose we take the other path, setting out this time from E, but from a special kind of E that does not express veritable deep compassion, but does still suggest entering into another's experience, though perhaps less intensely. The E, namely, that conveys the impression of inquisitiveness, curiosity. Let us say we have a play where we find we have to take our start in this mood. We are curious to know what will happen. We are all expectation. We pass on, as the play proceeds, to A and E, and come then to U. That is to say, we begin to find ourselves apprehensive, lest things may perhaps not turn out well. That is, then, the path that the play takes. But now, it is essential that we do not go on from apprehension into fear. We must on no account pass from U to U, for then our play would have an unhappy ending, and that is not the intention. We must, in fact, now go back. And as we return, we are brought into a mood of relief and satisfaction, A. Thus the circle of the vowels gives us first the sequence, fear, compassion, wonder, and then, another time, the sequence, curiosity, apprehension, relief, happy ending. With the first sequence, we have tragedy, and with the second, comedy. The terms are, of course, categorical. You will not find that the course of a play ever exactly fits into them. They can, however, provide an excellent basis upon which you can study how to stage your play. Thus, in dealing with the text of a play, we have first to study it from the point of view of delineation of character, and then go on to probe to the very heart and essence of its form. Readers aside, there's then a chart of everything he's just talked about. I'm not going to repeat that. So this is the end of Lecture 13.